Writing. Creative Writing, Introduction by Remote. Presented by Martin Kevening. Week 4.
Good evening, and you're all very welcome to Week 4 of your Creative Writing Introduction Remote course. So this is an audio recording of the tutorial section of the course prepared for those of you who cannot attend the live video conference. You'll already have received an email containing the PowerPoint presentation package, which contains all of the slides I will be discussing over the next hour or so. So what I would like you to do now is to check your email, if you haven't already done so, and download the file named Week 4, which I sent you. You can pause, of course, the audio while you do this if you like. Okay, so you should now be looking at the first slide on the presentation. You'll see the date, title, the title of Bad World, and a photo of a young gentleman accessing a motor vehicle. Now, before I go into the presentation, I'm just going to recap on where we are in this course, just for any that have been, you know, attending video conferences or missed classes, etc., here and there. So just to recap, we started the course with the course outline, an introduction to poetry, and indeed you all wrote some very nice poetry. Week 2 was spent discussing approaches to writing, how to get started, setting up your writing location, and even your writing method. We also discussed realism and writing in the realist form. In Week 3, we engaged with the topic of what it is to be a writer and looked at various ways we can help ourselves sustain our writing practice in the long term, if you remember. We also looked at the science fiction genre and read some of your pieces which you'd written the week before in the realist form. So tonight we are at the halfway point in your course. So this is week 4, and tonight, if you'd like to slide on, click on to slide 2. Tonight we're going to be looking at the craft of self-editing, and we'll also have a discussion, a brief discussion on the crime genre. We'll also have a look at writing a synopsis. Okay, so now we've started writing a draft. What do we do next? Or we've completed our first draft. So click on to slide 3 there, please. Revisions. Yes, I like to break this up into re and vision. You are actually re-looking at the work with cold eyes. A draft is a first effort. Every time you rewrite, that is essentially another draft. So the first time you write something, like we did in the writing exercises in the course so far, that essentially is a draft. Yes, I know, of course, there are many different processes. I mean, there are people who start stories in the middle of their narrative. What they start with becomes the middle and vice versa. And you can start at different points in your story. There's no doubt about that. But just from the point of view of being a beginner, I've just kind of tried to keep it fairly straightforward and to say that the way I revise tonight is to write the first draft down as if I'm reading the story. So I'm starting my story at the beginning, just to keep it quite simple. For this kind of an introduction course, we're talking about writing our story from the beginning. You can always develop, of course, your method later on. And I actually still write stories, generally speaking, I write stories from the beginning. So I start where the reader will start reading, essentially. In broad speaking now, sometimes you will find that you will remove the first three or four lines because they're kind of an artifact of where you were just writing yourself, as has been described as writing yourself into the story, kind of getting yourself into the story. And those first few lines are basically just kind of drawing the pictures for yourself rather than something that's actually readable. And you might cut those first few lines away when you go back to it or later on. Often found that with early stories where I wouldn't have started really. And even now it is, the first few sentences might be a bit just unnecessary and repetitive. So that they could be cut out. But in the broader sense, if you're writing about a man, as I've often used this example, the man that gets up in the morning and goes to the bank and robs it and runs away, I'm starting the story in the morning when he gets up, when he wakes up. So it might be useful to talk about that way as a beginner. When I'm writing a short story then, which, let's say it's very, like short stories in Ireland are usually around 2,000 words or Sometimes they can be more than that, but a lot of magazines stipulate 2,000 words. I know in America, short stories are usually a lot longer than that, but 2,000 words. So you could realistically write 2,000 words in the day if you wanted. The last few stories I've written, of course, have been a lot longer. The last one I wrote was over 14,000. Obviously, I didn't write all that in one morning. I'd kind of limit myself to 2,000 to 3,000 words at a time. With a short story, then, I'll probably get the whole thing down before I go back to the start. So I'll write the whole story from beginning to end. I don't like to talk too much about my own process, really. I like to keep it more general. I don't want to be prescriptive or saying this is the way I do it, so you have to do it the same. No, it's not that. But just because obviously I know my own process better than any other writer, any other writer's process. So I'm kind of inclined to draw my own experience. So in that case, I would kind of generally write about 2,000 to 3,000 words at a time. You might decide to write less or more than that. But there's no rule on that. So when I've written the story and got the whole thing down before I start, I go right back to the start, and I will actually literally rewrite the whole thing. Now, I want to emphasize this, as it does come up in classes a lot, and I say it, and you know, sometimes people, I don't know, don't fully get the interpret it differently or something. So I'm just trying to keep it fairly straightforward that when I did start writing stories, I would type them all out. I'd type it out on the laptop or on a computer, and then I'd simply move. I didn't go back to it and simply move things around, fix misspellings, fix a comma here and there. But as far as I was concerned, the draft itself was written, and I just simply save it as draft two, save it as draft three. I wouldn't ever actually literally rewrite the thing. I don't do it that way anymore. What I do now is literally rewrite the sentences all out again. It doesn't matter whether it's you're doing it by hand or on a computer. Although, as I've said before, handwriting is best to begin with for me. Well, that's a matter for each writer. But I always rewrite. I do the same with scripts, plays, anything, even a short poem, even a synopsis, even a log line, even a blurb for a novel or for a short story. I'm not going to go into the neurological processes at work here, because I'm not qualified to go into those processes. I don't know, and you don't need to know why this works or how the brain works. We just know that it works for me. Whatever way it works, the method of rewriting it is most effective for me. And I guess, I suppose, as Mike McCormick once put it when interviewing John McGahern, my first touch isn't good. That's not to say we don't respect what we've written. So you've got to, so the first time you write it is basically telling yourself the story, and you're then rewriting it. So it isn't sufficient to simply just move around the sentences for me. I have to actually rewrite the text. I have to rewrite the lines. And I was going to say there, when my research in John McGahern's archive, I noticed how he had literally transcribed drafts by hand into other copies, sheets of paper, and there wouldn't be an awful lot of changes. There might only be two or three words in each page changed, and that's kind of like in the last third or fourth drafts, your handwritten drafts, that you're actually changing just little bits and pieces, but they are fundamental to the overall story, changing one or two words here and there. So this is a kind of a process that I suggest you at least have an attempt at. It's not something we don't respect the first draft, we do, but when we rewrite the next day or weeks or months later, I mean, the longer you can leave between each draft, we are in a course here where it's a little artificial that we have to submit each week, although, sometimes with breaks in classes, you can have a few weeks, but in this case, you're kind of, every week you're submitting something, so slightly artificialized, but we don't really have any choice, because we don't have any more time, and we have to have submissions in every week. But when you go out and start working on your own practice, You might decide to leave work for weeks, days, weeks, or even months, and sometimes even years. And sometimes, and the longer it is, sometimes the better, because you know, you're much more objective when you come back to it. It's almost like it is somebody else's work that you're reading, and you're less kind of protective of it, and you're less kind of emotive about it. So you're more like, I mean, it's not that you don't enjoy the work or you don't appreciate the quality of the writing, and it's not that you're just going around looking for things to criticize. It's that you have a more balanced view, I think. So when you come back, you know, when you're writing your draft, don't just write it. Don't be critical of it while you're writing it. You can be assessing it later when you come back to it. So we're more forgiving, as I said, where we need to be, and more critical where required. So respect the first draft. Rewrite. I rewrite about 4 times by hand at the moment. I've kind of been doing that now for a number of years. More if the story is still not coming together, if it's still a long way off being something that would be, I would think, would be close to its final form, then I would have to keep rewriting. Usually, I seem to be able to, within about the 4th draft, I've gotten it to, because I think it kind of helps me in a way that I think I'm going to be doing 4 drafts, because I think, okay, when I get to the 3rd or 4th draft, I think this is enough messing now with this scene. We need to kind of figure out a way it's going to actually play out, it's going to actually work. We you know, so psychologically, I suppose the fact that I do kind of say I'm going to do about 3 or 4 drafts, I kind of say I'm not going to keep drafting this forever. You might say, well, why can't you do that the first draft? You just can't do that because you don't know, you don't know how it's going to play. I mean, have you ever thought of a great story in your head, and then when you sit down and you get out your sheet of paper and you start writing, it just won't come out like that. It just comes out some other way. Well, that happens to me a lot. And I kind of know it happens to me a lot now. I know it's going to happen to me. So when I get an idea, I know there's not much point thinking about it too much. There's not much point planning it. Although other writers have claimed to have a different process. But my process is that I would actually just start writing it and see how it would actually play out. That's kind of what I've experienced. And when I've done that, then... you know, that's when I can start to think about it again after the first, second draft. And then at that point, then when I have, I suppose it's, you've kind of stabilized the elements of your story. When you've got to the 3rd or 4th draft, you've got to the kind of stage where those elements are kind of in place and you're kind of happy with them. Not that you can't move them around. You can simply move anything around. But you kind of feel a bit more secure in the story that you have these drafts done. And it's almost like a I wouldn't say religious, but it's a kind of like a prayer almost that you're rewriting these words again, the same words again. It's like almost like a chorus or something. The words that are already in the story and that are good kind of secure, make you feel more secure about the rest of those pieces of the story that are still insecure. So if that makes sense at all. There are stories that just don't work and have to be abandoned. It's happened. It happens to me if I move away too much from what I know. You probably know the stories that I've published before. When I try to write something that's quite a long way from that, I lose the ability to complete it, and that's when I have to kind of, it's not that I couldn't write something, I couldn't attempt to write something that wasn't, where, you know, about Irish farmers or something like that. It's not that I couldn't attempt something far away, but I have found that very difficult sometimes when I do that. I find it very difficult to pull it off because I don't really know the terrain, and that's where I'd end up having to abandon. I have long works that I've had to abandon. They're still there, but I doubt they'll ever come to fruition. Not in their anything like their current form, anyway. You know, so they might come to their current form. They might come to fruition in another form, and that's happened to me a few times. I've kind of taken sections of something, and when I say sections, I don't mean literally blocks of text. I mean elements of the story, and kind of rework them into another story. But that can happen occasionally. I mean, more the yeah, as I'm saying, more the type of story rather than any geographical or temporal thing. So I type it up then, and I leave it for about 3 months. I don't bother printing them nowadays. I just type them up on the computer, and I'll always back them up online somewhere so that in case the computer explodes or something, I have a backup copy. I mean, this is something we just there should be no, there's no excuse really for losing copies nowadays. Certainly not after this course, because I will emphasize that you need to back up your work. You know, save it on an online server somewhere. If it's emailing it to yourself, is probably the simplest way of doing it. Don't be worried about somebody stealing it. It's better to save it, send it in your email, or save it as a draft in your email, or else upload it obviously to the cloud cloud services that are out there. With short stories, I usually leave them for around 3 months. With a novel, you might do you might leave it for longer. You might leave it for 6 months. But then I would go back and I'll rewrite, I'll retype. So I'll have two documents. I'll have a new document up on the laptop, side by side with the draft, and I'll literally write out, type out each sentence. That's exactly what I do. Type out each sentence, and until I have the whole story. It doesn't matter if I think I'm gonna, well, I'm not gonna change any of this paragraph or that. I mean, after a while you realize there's never going to be a paragraph that you won't change in some way when you rewrite it, you know. You'll change a word here, you'll change something here. I mean, at the start, you could change quite a lot of things. Even at that sixth draft stage, you'll be changing. Well, this is my process of writing anyway. Yes, I'll change around a few things, change around a few sentences. Yeah, okay, yeah, you might get a few paragraphs that very little changes. That's fine though, because it's also kind of, it's called also kind of reiterating the overall, the global revision, the overall kind of, the overall story itself. And then when I have done it about two more times, seven, eight times, then I do what I used to do quite a long time ago. And as I said at the start, I move sentences around, I fix up dialogue, I expand on descriptions. Yeah, I might check descriptions here and there. You know, is this description making sense? You know, sometimes in the third or fourth draft, you'll see descriptions and you'll use some term and you'll say, I know that's, I'm not sure about that, or maybe some historical reference. And I say, I'm not sure about that, but there's no need to re really research it then, unless it's a really significant. I mean, if your story is based on the last day of the First World War and you're there writing it and you don't know if that's the right date, then that's something you need to check straight away. But if it's just something like a kind of jacket your First World War soldier was wearing, and that's it's not really a big part of the story, it's just a detail of his jacket, that's something you can check later. You know, you don't need to really worry too much about it. Having said that, sometimes it can be useful to have the name of those types of things, because that name might become something, you know, significant in another way in the story. So sometimes it is useful. I mean, the more research you've done before you start writing is better. It's more, it makes you more informed, but at the same time there's a danger of just over researching before you ever start. And some people have that issue where they just keep researching and researching and researching for years and they never actually write anything. So that's just a kind of a thing about revisions on details and such like that. It's the fun part, but it comes much play much later in the process for me nowadays. Right, let's take a look now at slide four, and I just want to talk a little bit about the modes of revision. So there are broadly speaking two types of revision, global revision and local revision. So what do these two mean? Well, global revision is where you look at the big picture of your work. It's the broad twists and turns of your plot, if there is a plot. Using my example again of the man who got up one day and robs the local bank and then runs away. So the global revision is perhaps, does this story make sense? Does it all fit together? Why does, I mean, if it's a crime novel, it has to fit together. It's not a kind of a story. It's a crime genre is not something you can just usually it's not something like that's just kind of making a comment on humanity, although it can do that, but it has to do other things as well, including have a clear story. So why does the man rob the bank? What circumstances led him to do that? How did he get away with the robbery if he did? How does he get to the bank? What's his MO, method of operation? Why did he not get away with it? Questions like applied to the overall story like this are global revision questions. So you're taking the entire story as a whole piece and seeing does it work as a story? Does it make sense as a story? Is the reader likely to stay on board all the way to the end to see what the final outcome is going to be? Naturally, with literary fiction, where the emphasis is on the language used rather than simply just the twists and turns of the story, and where the emphasis is on the language used over the course of the story, it's more to do with is the overall kind of message of the book clear rather than the plot line. So if you're talking about literary fiction, is the book kind of is it kind of unified as one piece? If it's a book about disunity, for example, if it's about a book about things that are not unified, is it unified in its disunity? If that's okay, if that's acceptable to say. But mostly is it unified? Is the whole book working together as one thing? And that's kind of global revision, if that makes sense. Local revision then is where you look much closer, like you take out your magnifying glass and you zone in on sections of the piece. I mean, you might ask, could I have managed the part of this bank robber story where he leaves his house and goes to the bank any better? That section, is that working well? Is that engaging enough? Does he need to meet, for example, a strange man on the way? Or perhaps that section moves too fast. Maybe more needs to be described about that part of it. And then looking at why that section, or even the conversation with the bank robber and some character on the way, and how that plays out. You're zoning in more closely on that particular section. That's an example of more localized or micro vision. And it also, of course, refers to the way the sentences work and the way the paragraphs work. And I come to that shortly. Okay, so if you move on there to slide 5, and I'm going to look with a little more detail now at what to examine when you are at these later stages of editing. So after you've rewritten, 3 or 4 more times, you've typed it up and preferably taken a long break from it, and then you have typed it up a couple of more times and you feel it is where it needs to be. Well, that is where we start looking more closely at the items here on this slide. Okay, so plot, that's the sequence of events in this course. That's what it means in this course. That is the plot of the bank robber story. The plot of the bank robber story is he gets up, or she gets up. Well, let's say it's a he. He gets up, he goes to the bank, he robs the bank, and he runs away. That is the sequence of events. That is the chain of occurrences that make up the work. It doesn't mean that that those events are going to be told to the reader in that order, but that's what actually happens in order. He gets up, goes to the bank, and he robs it, and he runs away. If you want to change aspects, you might want to change aspects of the plot, and it often happens in crime stories where there are a lot of twists and turns, and it's a detective novel, that's always told retrospectively, so that all the events of the murder in a Sherlock Holmes, for example, or a crime have happened in the past, and this whole story is about how Holmes untangles the crime. So you know the sequence of events might be the crime, and then the following events of the detection, but the actual story is only about the detection, the deduction and capture of the criminal, if you're with me. So in the first draft, things are probably not in the correct order, and they may need to be changed. You know, I mean, believe it or not, you could write a story about that particular bank robber that goes to rob the bank, and the first draft might have him having a really expensive alarm clock waking him up, putting on this huge bathrobe, you know, having this enormous mansion, just because you didn't really think about your story when you started. And then when you rewrite, you say, oh, hold on a minute now, how can he rob a bank? Why is he robbing a bank if he's got this much money? If we want to keep it simple, we might say, well, maybe he should be just simply in a very kind of bare home, you know, very small flat with no curtains and no carpets and no heating. Maybe he's just squatting, and that tells us why he's robbing the bank. So you would then change, obviously, the aspects of the beginning to suit that. That's a very simplistic example of, I know that. But just to kind of emphasize what we're talking about here. Okay, so that's kind of the sequence of events and the way it's changed. So the plot is the one thing, and then the narrative is how that story is narrated. It's how that story is told, how those sequence of events is told. The narrative is how it's narrated. To narrate is the verb to means to tell a story, to tell something. And the way you tell the story could be quite different to the way the sequence of events happens. It's often, of course, the case with flashback stories. So moving on then to characterization. I've already mentioned before about perhaps writing a biography of your characters. It's not usually necessary in a short story, but it's very useful it's always useful in any project. It can be just a half page, a date for a novel, definitely I would suggest it. It can be just half a page. You can put in a date of birth. It's no harm to have a date of birth, just to give you a kind of a baseline. A record of education, employment, other things that might be relevant are economic status, political and religious beliefs, and known associates. And also health condition. This can seem like a chore, but it can also be very interesting and very, very, very helpful. Very useful to you as you're writing your project. You can bring in so many interesting and original aspects then to your character, which just makes your character so much more believable for the reader. I would always recommend doing this before you start your draft. So you might like to write your story first and then do the biography, because I sometimes like to let the characters introduce themselves to me without me kind of, you know, planning out their whole kind of life in intricate detail before I start, which can be disabling, because you just feel, oh, I have to stick with this now, this is the person, this person has this many beliefs, this person has this, that, and the other. I don't work well like that. I'd rather write the draft and then maybe after the first or second draft, then say, okay, I probably need to do a half page biography of this person, just to give me an idea of where they're coming from as a person. It's character development, basically, is what it is. And it's how to do it. We've had the discussion before about whether to use people you know as a character. This is a complicated question. I feel it does happen automatically in a very indirect way. For me, I don't write directly about people related to me as a norm. It just doesn't really usually work for me. Some successful novelists, I mean, have made a career out of writing, obviously, about their family as characters in their work. But I see it quite difficult. It's quite difficult not to be emotive or kind of judgmental about characters like that. What I'd suggest is the selection of, if you want to use a character, if you're struggling to make a real character, or you feel that your characters are too just there for the sake of being characters, if you want to kind of, find something that's more kind of real as a character, you could just pick somebody that you know distantly, such as somebody in the local shop, somebody that's not very close to you, but that you do know or you've met, and that you recognize their kind of way of speaking, their way of perhaps their way of dressing, their way of doing tasks of various types. I mean, for example, if you wanted to write about a doctor, you might use a doctor that you have been to a few times, or a dentist, or if you have a character going into a shoe shop, then you, that shoe shop's person could be also useful as a other type of a shopkeeper. So it is a thing that can be very useful, and it helps to make their char your characters more kind of like real people, which is what you're generally aiming for. So, as I said, you select somebody, possibly somebody that you've met in a very distant way, and it'll soon become clear. This is kind of what I've experienced, that you don't really know this person at all. You don't really know them. You I mean you, you once you go past the superficial kind of phrases they have, the way they dress and the way they sell you shoes, you don't know anything about their personality really, unless you have a longer conversation with them. But what does happen sometimes is family members or people you know really well that you wouldn't be able to write about directly start bleeding out of this character, so they become kind of more like the per people that you know, or even yourself. And it's easier to write, it's easier to kind of infuse a character with some of the stuff that you would know, like your mother, your father, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your son, your daughter. Or your best friend, or somebody very close to you, maybe somebody that you had a lot of engagement with, though their kind of voice and their kind of persona can start bleeding out of this shopkeeper person that you basically don't know really at all, but you've kind of used as a kind of a frame. So that's probably what they mean by that's probably what some authors mean by using a character that is actually created from many different real people. So that is, in my way, in my opinion, a better way of creating an original character. You may have a different experience. That's it's just a suggested a route to fixing approaching a strong character creation. What is important about the character is that if the story is meant to incur the suspension of disbelief in your reader. Like, if you want the reader to feel they are actually in a fictional world and not simply looking at words on a page, then clearly it is essential that the character is convinced as real people. For this to happen, I suggested a biography, but also having specific character traits. So that's kind of also the colloquial kind of words that they use. And that leads me on to the next point, the dialogue. Your character and all the characters use dialogue generally. The unsuspecting person in your shop that you are using in your creative work may use phrases. If you do use a phrase like that, an odd phrase or a kind of unusual phrase, make sure that they use it consistently. Check also that your dialogue is give and take. Just a few tips on the dialogue. Can't go into it in great detail here, but check that your dialogue is give and take. Shorter, unless you're writing something Shakespearean-esque. Modern stories, modern dialogue, and that dialogue is usually quite short. Clipped is the industry term. Dialogue, of course, means two or more people are speaking. Monologue is just one speaker, and that can work for first-person narratives, which I'll get to in a minute. Just to say that dialogue is something writers are either very good at or find very challenging. So I'm going to shelve any more of the dialogue discussion until the last few weeks of the course, where we will be talking about stage and screen, and obviously they are almost solely made up of dialogue. Okay, you have their descripteme, which comes from the discipline of narratology. We may not have come across it before. It's a kind of it's a word coined by Didier Coste in 1989, and simply means a sentence. Didier Coste is a narratologist. It's written on narratology. And he has a book called Narrative as Communication, first published in 1989, and it simply means describing a sentence in prose which is completely descriptive. it doesn't directly propel the story. For example, I'm just going to have I just have some sentences here now from the imaginary story about the man going to the bank. So, for example, the man woke up, the room was cold, the man got out of bed. So sentence two, the room was cold, of these three sentences is, you can obviously, you can repeat them there to hear them again. Sentence two of these three is a descripteme. The first sentence and the last sentence are narratemes. That's another narratological term. The narrateme is a sentence which progresses the narrative. Skilled writers combine narratemes and descriptemes, so a sentence that both narrates and describes. For example, the man looked out the curtainless window. In this one, we know the man is looking out the window. We also know he doesn't have any curtains. I mean, this raises a number of questions. He could have just moved in. He may not care about curtains, or he may not be able to afford curtains. And it progresses the story, but also describes it quite gently. Sorry, it describes it, but also progresses it quite gently. So focalization then means the place you put the camera in as you tell your story, where you have asked your reader to view or receive the story. The choice of perspective is fundamental here. So there's just some examples. First person narrative means a subjective inner voice is telling us the story. For example, I got up at 8. Today I would rob the High Street Bank. I got up. I looked out the curtainless window. A third person narrator is also called omniscient or godlike. It is an unidentified and usually unidentifiable narrator who tells the reader the story, sometimes with no interference, sometimes, on the other hand, permitting access to the character's mental processes. Here's an example of this with and without access to the main character's thoughts. The man woke up at 8. He remembered that today was the day he would rob the High Street Bank. He got out of bed. He looked through the curtainless window. So the second example is the man woke up at 8. He got out of the bed. He looked through the curtainless window. So the second one there, as you can see, we don't have the access. If you want to repeat those two readings, you'll notice that the second one doesn't have that access to the man's mental processes, which is called, the access is called free and direct discourse. So sometimes in the third person narrator will allow some access to that person's thoughts. Rarely you will see a second person narration being used. Here's an example of this. You woke up at 8. You knew today was the day you would rob the High Street Bank. You got out of the bed. You looked out the curtainless window. So that is second person narration. It's not often used. First and third are the most common. Some tutors argue third is easier, but the first person narration is more rewarding for the reader as they really get to know the character. Sometimes third is a better choice instead of a novel which has multiple first-person narratives. But rather than having many different first-person narratives in a novel, you might just decide to go for a third-person narrative throughout. It's a matter for each writer to decide. In your revisions, to recap, you assess the plot, the narrative, the characterization, the dialogue, the descriptions, and the focalization, not necessarily in that order. Also check on other cuts and additions. Obviously, you can move sections of your story or your novel around, change around dialogue and character, and do whatever seems right to you as you're going through it. But these are the basic things to investigate. And if you do them separately, which I admit is not always easy, it helps you to be more thorough in your self-editing phrase. Okay, so moving on now to slide 6 for a little on really localized revisions. This comes down then to sentences, words, and as I said, dialogue. Check each sentence is doing everything it should be in the story. Have you chosen the right word? Is dialogue realistic if that is the intention? I'd also mention the way you indent your paragraphs and space out your work. Be conscious, because all these things make a big difference to the way the reader takes in the work. Be conscious of breaks in scenes. Do you use hard paragraphs? That is where there is no indent. Now, if you don't know what an indent is like a longer space, and the indent is up on the left of the Q button on your keyboard. If you tab that, it'll indent the text rather than using the space bar. So it is good, it is important of that indented paragraph or not, whether or not to indent your paragraph. Very important. You may want to use a series of asterisks, which some writers do, to show that there is a break in time. It's very important that you know how you have presented, or you're aware of how you've presented your indents and spacing. And as I said, as all of this can direct a reader's receipt of the material. Okay, on slide 7 there, I have some practical ideas for the self-editing phase. As I've already said, I handwrite most of my first drafts. I usually type the first draft of a short story, the fifth draft of a short story. You might like to print off your story, annotating, like writing in comments as you read through it. And there is, of course, can be a point where you're simply changing things instead of making them better. That's what, when it's time to share your work with someone else, and that's what we'll be discussing next week. Now, on slide 8, I have a few brief reflections of crime fiction, which is our focus this week. We've read the first chapter of Gallows Lane by Brian McGilloway. McGilloway was a schoolteacher who started writing crime novels a few years ago. He has written quite a few based on the detective who's the main character in this story. It's a popular work written in a clear, unobtrusive style. Crime fiction is very popular. A typical detective story, as I said, like the Holmes story or other Agatha Christie stories, starts with a body, and they're always retrospective. All of the action has happened before the novel begins. Not the case here with McGilloway, or many, not really the case with McGilloway, but often crime fiction authors now change around that. But it is, as I said, the common method of the classic detective novel writers. So just to paraphrase this quote here from David Arnold, who makes the point that it is not criminals usually who write crime fiction. So if it basically means if you want to write crime, you need to research it. Now, I want to surprise you. So take out your pen and paper. I take it you have your pen and paper ready. So we're just going to do a writing exercise now. So I'm guessing that there is no one listening who has never in their entire life committed a single crime. In other words, everyone listening has committed a crime. I'm not just talking about breaking the law. I'm talking about any crime, even stealing a classmate's favorite pencil sharpener, as in any moral crime. Or any other type of crime you can think of. So what I want you to do now is think of the worst crime you've ever committed and write about it for the next 5 minutes. Okay? Don't think about it too much. Just start writing for the next 5 minutes. Pause the audio while you're doing this. Good luck. Well done. Okay, so I hope you got some good material there to work with. Now, here's another long quote on slide 9. Another narratologist, Julia Kristeva. If you study this quote, you do get a sense of the scholarly view on why we like crime fiction. Really, the fact is, crime fiction is very popular. People enjoy reading about characters doing bad things. Some tutors have argued that we don't have to do the crimes ourselves. We can just watch them being done, and we get a nice enjoyment of seeing the criminals getting caught and getting brought to justice. So finally tonight, a few words on the synopsis, writing a synopsis. I'm often asked about this. I'll talk more about the publishing process later in the course. But for novels, you are usually required to send in the first 3 chapters along with a synopsis. This is usually written in the present tense. For example, John Smith, 35, gets up one day with a plan to rob the High Street Bank. Now, you can, of course, write it for yourself too. Early in your drafting stage, it wouldn't normally be necessary for a short story. However, for a novel, especially a plot-driven novel, I would say some kind of plan is essential, and which of course can be altered later. But that's a plan for yourself. But if you're sending a synopsis to agents or publishers, they often ask for synopsis of a page or 500 words. You have to include the ending and the ending of the story. That's very important, and any major revelations throughout. Don't leave out any very, very important aspects of the book. So I've said a lot about crime tonight, but the crime genre is, as I said, very, very popular, and it's written generally in a very clear style. The details of crimes are key. That's kind of one of the key parts of a crime piece, is how the crime was perpetrated, generally speaking, and because crime readers want to know how the crime was done, and they also want to know if the criminal is going to get caught. So that's kind of some of the main general aspects of crime fiction. So if you move on now to slide 12, you'll see that Human World is next week. I've sent you on the readings already. Don't forget to submit a piece written in Bad World this week, focused on the breaking of a law, legal or otherwise. Can be from what you've wrote there over 5 minutes, or it can be something else, or it can be a bigger project. But around 500 words, please. Don't forget to send it to me and to your peer group in this course by the usual deadline that we have in this course. You can also, if you want, you could also send it, or alternatively send a synopsis of our proposed project if you like, and give you feedback on that. So I look forward to talking to you again next week. Thanks for listening to the tutorial, and I hope you have a good week's writing. Goodbye.
Produced with Audacity and Martin Kevany Creative Writing. Music track Dortmund by Alexander Nakarada, SerpentSoundStudios.com. Please note this recording is for your personal use and should not be shared or published in any way. Martin Kevany Creative Writing 2020.